Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC here on ESPN Plus. Wednesday, I'm going to go for, is the day today. Later on in the show, Charlie Stiletano with me with some exciting news, plus an exclusive interview where he sat down with Gareth Bale and spoke about that banner. Be sure to stay tuned for that. Also with us, Shakir Hislop, taking us down memory lane. Would you believe it is 24 years to the day in which Kevin Keegan made that famous rant against Sir Alex Ferguson? We'll get his recollections of that. Craig Burley with us as well, plus Julian Laurent and Gab Marcotti. We start, though, by all these different stories that are going on at the moment about the return of football in Europe. We'll start in Spain. This is what the president of the Spanish FA had to say. Javi Tebas came out and said, "I do not understand why there would be more danger in playing football behind closed doors with all precautionary measures than working on an assembly line, being on a fishing boat on the high seas, etc. In my opinion, France's decision is hasty. Other countries are already training. That's the example to follow. If important economic sectors cannot restart, they could end up disappearing. That could happen to professional football." Meanwhile, this is what the FIFA chief doctor had to say, Michel Touge. "My proposal is, if it is possible, avoid playing competitive football in the coming weeks. Try to be prepared for the start of good competition next season. Believe me, I regret it profoundly because I'm a football man. I'm a little bit afraid that to have a complete solution, we will have to wait until we have a vaccination program." Meanwhile, this is what the chairman of UEFA's medical committee, Tim Meyer, had to say. "Under these conditions and in full respect of local legislation, it is definitely possible to plan the restart of competition suspended during the 2019-2020 season." In England, a lot of optimism, of course, last week. That seems to have been somewhat diluted by the fact that some players aren't keen to return. To get to the bottom of all of this, I want to welcome in Gab Marcotti and Julian Laurent. And I know it's almost an impossible question to answer, and it's something that, you know, I was very optimistic over the last few days that, yes, things can get back to normal. But France cancelling their season until September is surely a hammer blow for those expecting football to return sooner rather than later. Gab, what do you make of just all of this?
All right, first things first. All those guys you mentioned, everybody is talking from their own perspective. Michel Touge, look, the dude is Belgian. He is head of the medical committee, but it's not like he's gone. He's not an epidemiologist. He hasn't gone and studied this whole thing. He's just kind of giving his opinion. Remember, FIFA don't really have skin in the game in terms of restarting this summer or restarting in September. UEFA, on the other hand, well, they represent the big clubs. And obviously they'd like to finish the Champions League, and they want their stakeholders, the clubs and the leagues, to be able to finish their leagues. So obviously the guy comes out and he says, well, the conditions are there. It would be great if we could restart. Well, yeah, sure, Captain Obvious. If the government say you can play and it's safe to play, then people will play. Javier Tebas, I don't even know where to begin with this guy, making a comparison between playing football, which is a physical sport, and a team sport where you've got people in close quarters with working on an assembly line or going out fishing on the high seas. I mean, look, it's an absurdity, right? The reality here is that governments are going to decide this. They're the ones who are going to give the green light. The situation is different in different countries. There's different sensibilities in different countries. There's different access to medical care in different countries, different access to testing. All these situations are different. In terms of what they're going to play again, I think that the biggest bellwether is going to come on Thursday. That's when we expect the German government to express an opinion on the Bundesliga plan. The Bundesliga have been far, far and away ahead of everybody else. They want to start potentially as early as May 9th or May 16th. And they'll get, hopefully they should get the thumbs up or the thumbs down from the government. And look, it's the government that's going to have the last word in each of these countries. If they can do it in Germany, then I think other countries have a shot.
The thing that strikes me, Jules, is how different the approach can be, considering France and Spain have had similar curves regarding COVID and the way in which it's developed. How can France be in a situation where I'm like, right, nothing's going to happen until September, and they got Tebas coming out and saying, look, we want to get back as soon as possible?
It's interesting because obviously the French Prime Minister announcing that yesterday on Tuesday was a big shock. We didn't really see it coming until Tuesday morning when we were briefed that he was going to announce it. They just didn't think that it was safe enough for the players to go back playing, even behind closed doors, for the people around them, the staff, stewards at the club, in the stadiums, everybody around, those 300 or 350 people who will have to be in the stadiums, even behind closed doors, that it was not safe enough. The risk was too big to take just for football, with all the implications and financially and everything that you want, of course. But it was still too much of a risk to have those games being played even in June, maybe even in July, August. There was a possibility, but they didn't want to take the risk. It's as simple as that.
Gab, meanwhile, am I right in saying, like, in the UK, the government are very much the driving force behind trying to get football back?
Yeah, and that's actually making the Premier League and some Premier League clubs uncomfortable. The government have briefed that, you know, they think it would lift morale if they can come back. And obviously, look, obviously doing it safely. Right now, we're still here in the UK. We're still under lockdown until May 7th. But, you know, they certainly brought back a plan to do it. The trouble is the Premier League, they actually care about their image. They're saying, we don't want to necessarily go back until it's entirely safe, until it's been made clear that we're not diverting resources from elsewhere. I think there's certain Premier League clubs that are asking themselves, wait, is it really worth it? Are all the costs to go and do this safely, is all of this worth it? And there's also, as our colleague Alex Shaw reporting today, there's some players who are saying, you know what? I don't trust these guys. I don't feel safe. I don't want to come back. So you've got different stakeholders with different views. But I think the one thing to remember, and I find this really shocking about the Premier League, is that Spain, Germany, and Italy all have very specific protocols that they've released to the public, they've released to the government for examination about how they're going to play when they come back, and they go into great detail. The Premier League haven't done that yet. They meet on Friday. Maybe they'll come up with a plan then. But the fact that they haven't until now kind of makes you wonder whether that appetite to go come back is really as strong as some people suggest.
This is all conjecture, and I know this, and I, and it's not like predicting a score or anything like that, but I am interested, Jules, just personally, how do you feel? Do you think we're going to see football back?
I think we will see football back in England, for example. I can only speak about France and England here, from the information I have. I think it will be back in England, maybe not in June, maybe more at the beginning of July. I still find June very, very early and very ambitious. If you think about the situation right now in the country, again with tests, with people dying, people fighting it, people contracting the virus still every day, I don't think it would be safe enough for football players to go back playing in June. In July, I think it would probably be okay and that they will do it. I can see the emotional connection that football have with people in the UK, in England, maybe bigger than in France. So I can take that in consideration as well. And I think there will be football, but not before July, in my opinion.
Gap?
I think Jules is right. I think there may be football. Again, I'll feel much better about this after we see what happens with Germany. But I think what we might see, even though it's not what the leagues want right now, we might see a situation where football comes back in a reduced form. If there's a way to come back and maybe move to a playoff system to settle European places, settle relegation places, possibly settle champions, but simply play fewer games, more controlled circumstances, you can throw more resource at them, it becomes more cost effective. That might even allow you to finish the Champions League possibly under those circumstances somewhere, somehow. Obviously, we'd be talking July at this point. Then I think right now, if I had to bet, that would be, I think, the most realistic scenario. But again, this could all change. Let's all sit and observe what Germany do.
Last word on this. Gab mentioned the Champions League. Jules, obviously 24 hours since the decision for France to cancel football up until September within the country. What does this mean for PSG and Lyon?
Well, Lyon is a bit different because they have a second leg to play away from home in Turin against Juventus whenever that would be possible to do. So you don't have the same issue as with PSG, who will have for sure a quarterfinal home game to play at some point. Potentially in August, that's when the Champions League, UEFA want the Champions League to be finished, and they won't be able to. So they will have to play their home game away from home, again, in a neutral ground somewhere abroad, which is obviously not ideal. They won't have any games to prepare before the Champions League, you would think, because they can't play again. So maybe training games, that's all they could do. So it's far from ideal, but they said we're committed to focusing now on the Champions League, which is the right thing to do. But for UEFA, it was a nightmare. The worst that could happen was one of the big five leagues to cancel their league like France have done. And for PSG, it's a nightmare as well, because that's far from ideal when you have high ambition for the Champions League.
Gab and Jules, thank you very much. Jules, must be a rarity that you get to speak this much with Gab in the conversation as well. Just a reminder, the latest edition of the Gab and Jules podcast that drops tomorrow. Be sure to check it out. Tor Christian Carlsen was given the task of naming the top 36 players under 21. Here is the top 10. Kylian Mbappe, number 1. Jadon Sancho, 2. Trent Alexander comes in at 3. Jules is still with us as we welcome Craig Burley into the show as well. Craig, Jadon Sancho, 2. Do you agree with that?
Look, I don't really have an issue, but I mean, I was looking at... I had to look up Marcus Rashford, and stupidly I realised he was 22. Because I think, you know, Rashford's performances for United could have shoehorned him in if he'd been the right age. Silly point, really, because he's not. But, you know, Jadon Sancho's a talent that clearly...
Yeah, useless point, irrelevant and needless.
Yeah, well, you know, true to course. So, you know, why change now? Just because there's a lockdown. I looked at João Felix at 10. And I think that's purely based on he's not really hit the ground running. We certainly haven't seen the best of him. He's way higher up than 10. But, you know, ahead of Vinicius Jr. and one or two others for me, as is Erling Haaland. But if you're just talking about Jadon Sancho, I mean, he's getting propelled into that category by a lot of people. He's, you know, I know we're going to talk about a potential for a big move for him. And then the pressure is really going to be on him. But, you know... Is he one of the more talented and most talented youngsters in Europe? It's hard to argue against that.
Would you have him at 2, Jules?
Yeah, I agree with TK on his top 3, I have to say. I think he's still quite below Mbappe, and I think a lot of them are, regardless of how talented they all are. And it's a very impressive list if you look at it in full. Those 36 players who are all under 21... on May the 1st, it's a hugely talented list. It's very impressive, but I still think Mbappe is way above everybody else. But yeah, for the top, Sancho a second, for me, it makes sense. He has a wonderful season before we had to stop it. And he will certainly leave in the summer for a lot of money to a bigger club than Borussia Dortmund, and deservedly so.
Great. So far we've got Marcus Rashford is 22 and Mbappe is very good. Thank you very much, gents. Right. Let's talk about Jadon Sancho then, shall we, Jules? Obviously, Manchester United heavily linked to the Englishman. Where are we on this?
Well, we are that Ed Woodward, as we mentioned on the show on Monday, I think he was, trying to not be too clear about what United are going to do. No, we're not going to spend a lot of money. We don't have much money to spend. Not much will happen this transfer window anyway this summer, which is obviously not very true. United are still very much leading the race for Jadon Sancho. As we reported many times on the show and on the website, there's already been talks between the two clubs, between Sancho and United as well. The other day he was doing a live Instagram and someone put a question and said, oh, sip a bit of water if you're going to sign for United. And what did he do? He drank the water, obviously. So, listen, I think it will happen. I think he will choose United. He will have a lot of clubs after him. He will pick whoever he wants. But I think United right now are by far the most serious contender.
Craig, he drank the water. What does that mean?
I don't know. It's like asking Nicol. He's just take a bit of shepherd's pie if he's going to do something. I mean, it's a given, isn't it? So I mean, I don't know. Should United go for him? Absolutely. They're in the process of trying to make big strides to close that gap. He is one of the most sought-after players out there. Borussia Dortmund will not and should not let him go for less than the valuation they have of him, and that'll be a lot of money. And, you know, at the end of the day, if it doesn't happen for him, hey, because of finances, he's at a very good club where he is. I mean, he's a very good learning curve, and he's playing in a good side. He's getting lots of games. So if a United move or any move doesn't come from when all this lockdown and pandemic is hopefully over, then the move will come sooner rather than later. I think the key for him is patience and making the right decision. And as I say, if it doesn't happen for whatever reason, he's at a brilliant club where he is at this moment in time.
Meanwhile, Jules, a highly regarded reporter in Germany, saying that Hans Flick had a conversation of over 30 minutes, the Bayern Munich coach, with Leroy Sané about a move from City to the Bundesliga.
Yes, and there's no surprise in that, in the sense that last summer, before he got that really bad injury, there were already a lot of talks between the two clubs as well. They were negotiating over his transfer. He wanted to go back to Germany, and there's really only Bayern Munich for him if he goes back to Germany. At that time, City wanted over 100 million euros, which is something that Bayern Munich were not ready to pay. And we, a year on, pretty much, let's say, and he hasn't played yet this season because of that bad injury, but obviously he's only 1 year away from the end of his contract at City, which means that his price has dropped significantly compared to last summer. And I think if you can get Leroy Sané, who will go back to full fitness and probably to his best or not far from his best, for 50 million euros, maybe even less than that, I think you take it. And again, he wants to go to Bayern Munich. Bayern Munich are looking for a player like him. It makes a lot of sense.
Seems to make sense, doesn't it, Craig? Seems a no-brainer.
Yeah, and no, it's been in the works for quite a while, so I would not be shocked. I think it's one of the moves that, when everything opens up again, is more than likely to happen. The interesting thing in this story, if true, and we discussed it just before we came on air, was the fact that these things have broken out. You know, the fact that there has possibly been a telephone call between a Manchester City employee and a Bayern Munich employee stroke head coach, which is breaching all the regulations of how you're supposed to go about your business. Now, if it is true, it just staggers me because, you know, we all know tapping up goes on. But surely to hell, if they've had a conversation, one of them says, listen, this can't go any further because we're not supposed to be doing this. So if I was Manchester City, I would not be particularly happy. Even though I know I'm probably going to lose the player, I don't think I would be too happy about an employee of mine under contract having a discussion with a manager at another club at this moment in time.
Jules, we know this happens, but it's incredible that this has become so public.
Yes, you're right. And it's not the first time in the last few days. We also had Jose Mourinho picking up his phone to call Thomas Meunier, and it's a different club. And Meunier is not the caliber of Leroy Sané, but it seems that those kind of things are leaked more and more now, especially when there's no football around. So we probably focus a bit more on transfer stories and what managers and players and agents are doing, which we probably shouldn't. But like Craig said, we know it's going on. It's just a shame when it goes public like this.
Just a reminder to keep up to date with all the latest transfer news. You can go over to the website and click on Transfer Talk.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with GEICO? We could save money and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
Be sure to go over to our YouTube channel. Plenty of content over there. Be sure to subscribe as well, as we welcome in Charlie Stilettano to the show. Of course, famous in the soccer community in the US and beyond. Also a presenter on SiriusXM FC alongside Neil Barnett and Ray Hudson. Now, these three have come together to launch a podcast named The Hat Trick. The first one drops tomorrow and they are starting in some style an exclusive interview with Real Madrid's Gareth Bale. Here's a clip of it, Bale talking about that flag.
But after that one game, when the banner came out, Gareth, how much did you know about it? The one that said Wales, Golf, Madrid, in that order. It was hysterical. But I guess you had to have a good sense of humor, which a lot of the Spanish lads at Real Madrid did not. But it all got glossed over.
They did not. A bit of
humor. Or did it?
I'd seen the banner the boys had showed me, I think, a few weeks before or whenever it was, from pictures online and stuff, and were just joking around. And a few of them were just saying after the game, if we do qualify, let's try and find it and bring it out. I was like, oh, do what you want, but I won't be good enough to get it. But yeah, obviously they finally brought it down, and we were all celebrating as a team. And like I've said before, like, I'm not going to not jump around with my teammates. Yeah. It was a bit of banter. It was a bit of fun. People can see it how they like, but we were just celebrating on the pitch as a country to qualify and just having a laugh. It was just one of those things.
Charlie, what a way to start off your podcast series.
Yeah, no, we were quite pleased. Thanks, Dan. First of all, thanks for having me here today. It was extraordinary, really was. The human element, if you will, the human being, Gareth Bale, came out. That's what really came out in the interview. And I was, you know, over the years, you get to know so many different people and you know, you have these personal conversations with them, and you hope it comes out during one of these podcasts. And it certainly did in this case, and it certainly does. We have other podcasts with Lothar Matthäus, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, Gennaro Gattuso. Marco Materazzi tells us about the headbutt and the reason he felt insulted. It's extraordinary. It's great stuff. We hear from people like Patrick Kluivert talking about the young American kid in the Barcelona camp. So there's a lot of fun things in these podcasts.
What else struck you from speaking to him?
Struck me how much a manager matters, really. That, to me, was the most interesting part of it, that it matters for the player's development and whether or not even becomes a professional. He talks so much about how his only goal was to make it at Southampton, to make it to the first team. And he was extraordinary when he got called up for the first time. He said he couldn't believe it. And his sights are very realistic. And I think in some ways he's overachieved what he really started out to achieve. He's become one of the biggest players on the planet, and he's demonstrated, you know, in the big moments, very few people come through as much as Gareth Bale does.
Do you think he minds the reputation that he has in Spain?
Yeah, I had a sense that he was disappointed. Is the best way to say it, in the fans' reaction. You know, you talk about, especially the English fans, they usually support the team, the players, even in difficult times. But, you know, at the Bernabeu, as we know, and I've been there when they've booed Cristiano Ronaldo, they've booed Iker Casillas. You know, it's just a matter of, I guess it's a rite of passage in some way. But I think he put a little finer point on it. What he really said is, I don't think it helps, and not sure why people do it. And he seemed a little bit, almost, you know, confused as to why a fan would do that.
Do you think he's going to stay? What was your gist from the conversation? Do you think he'll stay in Madrid?
I think he likes Madrid. I think he likes the idea of being at the biggest club in the world, or certainly one of the biggest clubs in the world. I think he's been a player that he feels he still has more to prove, I think, to the fans and the manager. That's the sense that I got. I do think he misses a little bit of being sort of the straw that stirs the drink, you know, the main guy on the team. I think that's something he misses, and maybe his next adventure he'll try to do that again. I think he seemed happiest when he was at Spurs. At least that's the impression I got. And that's more because I think his players and the managers relied on him. And the same thing with Wales. And I think he really thrives off of that.
Well, it's a great get for your first podcast. Charlie, just stay with me, because I wanted to talk to you about something else. Because it was interesting. Okay. I was reading Football 365, who listed the top five net spenders of the last 5 years. And I think you can pretty much guess Manchester City's there, PSG, Manchester United. But fourth, though, AC Milan, which really struck me, considering this is a side that hasn't been in the Champions League since 2013. I want to welcome back to the show Gab Marcotti as well to the conversation. But Charlie, I want to start with you. These are striking figures.
Yeah, it really is. And as a lifelong Milan fan, Gab's a lifelong Inter fan, so he feels much better about this. I think what hits you is that they've spent a lot without being able to sell these guys onwards. And, you know, the club to me that's done a great job with this, maybe because they own about 100 players, is Chelsea. And they were able to capitalize when the market, you know, was good in China. And so they were able to sell some players for, you know, high profits in China. It seems like the AC Milan players they've gotten haven't really panned out. And they have to give them up for, you know, for nothing compared to what they paid for them. And to me, that seems to be the real problem they're faced with.
Gab, have they got it so wrong?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a number of things going on. I mean, you know, they've had three different owners in those 5 years. And, you know, you look at the tail end of the Berlusconi-Galliani regime, you know, they were thinking of getting out. They spent money, but they didn't necessarily didn't have that clear idea. In between, you had the disastrous Li Yonghong, Marco Fassone era, where, you know, they were just chucking money around left, right, and center, right? And again, one bad decision after another, I think a lot of question marks. And, you know, these new owners that are in now, Elliott Management, they've got very clear ideas about how they want to turn things around. They've inherited, though, a very, very difficult position. I think a lot of the damage was done under the previous owners, under Li Yonghong, where they said, all right, we're way into a hole. We want to bring the club back. Let's invest a ton of money, hope that we go on and win the league and you know, qualify for the Champions League. And so we'll make up for it with the revenues on the other end. And, you know, when that doesn't happen, you dig yourself into an even bigger hole. And that's kind of what part of the reason why Milan are in the situation they're in now.
Charlie, we asked Gab to give the top five worst transfers during that period. Carlos Bacca at 5, Higuain at 4th, Piantic comes in at 3, Biglia at 2, Lucas Paqueta at number 1, signing for almost 40 million euros. Do you agree with that? Paqueta was the worst of them all?
Yeah, I think so. At least where we see now, where he is right now in the pecking order, if you will. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to the transfer market. I don't think any of us know whether it's going to collapse or what, but no one thinks it's going to spring back and we're going to see crazy numbers. So to get rid of these guys, it seems like they're always selling them on for a loss. And, you know, they have to get it right to at least get into the Champions League. And that's where the money is. And, yeah, I mean, it's not a mystery, and it's a team that has a lot of decent players, but I like to say a lot of players are all pretty much the same. They're about the same quality. You see, even a guy like Ibrahimovic at 38 years old changes the whole dynamic of the team because of the quality of player that he is. And that, you know, in the old days, you'd get 20-year-old guys and 22-year-old guys and 26-year-old guys coming in at AC Milan that were that caliber. Not when they're 38. I mean, when they had Ibra the first time, he was 30 years old, and that was sort of the perfect Ibra. Now, even though he isn't as good as he was when he's 30, he still helps because he is a player of, let's say, significant magnitude. He really is. He makes a difference.
Gab, is there any light at the end of the tunnel for AC Milan fans like Charlie?
I mean, look, it's going to be a slow, painful step out of it, because in a financial fair play era, you pay for past mistakes. And Charlie said something before that it's absolutely critical, and I totally agree with, he mentioned Chelsea, but it's critical that you sell well. And some people might point to Carlos Bacca and say, well, he scored a fair few goals, you know, why do you have him on the list? Well, they didn't sell him well. You know, basically, they ended up giving him away in exchange for effectively Samu Castillejo. You have to be smart in terms of the deals that you sign and the contracts you sign players with. Lucas Biglia is on an enormous contract. They signed him when he was 31. It was obvious they were never going to get the resale value. And, you know, now you're stuck with him. And you're stuck with people like Çalhanoğlu and guys nobody wants. And what they have promised is they're going to go and they're going to be much more numbers-oriented and look for value. You saw a little bit the guys they signed last year, Theo Hernandez, Bennacer. Those guys are players. Those guys are young. They have resale value. They can do a job for you now. Frank Kessie, arguably, if he regains his mojo. You know, I think you can build around that, but you have to be smart in the way you do it. And unfortunately, they're inheriting some really big contracts. Some very, you know, if you'd asked me the five stupidest moves, I would have put Donnarumma's contract in there because he makes an enormous amount of money. And even though he's a phenomenal goalkeeper, he's now 12 months away from becoming a free agent. And of course, his agent is Mino Raiola, which nobody wants to deal with. So, you know, it's going to be difficult. But I do think you do see baby steps in the right direction. The key now is following through.
Yeah, I think that you really need to understand that this administration, if you will, under Ivan Gazidis is, and the Elliott Group, and still Paolo Maldini, thankfully, is a group that has inherited a lot of the problems. And I really have faith in this group that they're going to be able to, you know, to right the ship, if you will. But it's sort of where Inter Milan was 5-6 years ago. The difference is that Suning, being a retail giant, they can, let's just be honest, they can manipulate financial fair play. They could take some of the retail clout and bring it into the sponsorship side of the club, as many of these clubs have done. AC Milan with Elliott doesn't have that opportunity. So it's going to be a little harder, but they do have a solid financial backing. And if they start making some, as Gab pointed out, some really good, you know, good solid moves, then I think they're going to be okay. But it's going to take more time than I think any of us had dreamed of.
Charlie Solitano, thank you very much. Thank you very much as well for wearing a tie. Much appreciated. Just a reminder then, Charlie,
I need to say this. I'm only wearing a tie because whenever Sir Alex Ferguson watches you guys, he says, I don't understand why they don't have a tie and why they wear jeans. So, in the event that he sees this appearance, I want to say, I wore a tie for you, boss.
I like that, Charlie. You know, he's old. He'll expect those sort of standards, I suppose. Thank you very much then, guys. Just a reminder, Charlie's new podcast, along with Neil and Ray, drops tomorrow. That exclusive interview with Gareth Bale, the hat trick. Be sure to download it. Plus, go to our website as well. Plenty of podcasts to download over there.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So, at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now, it's our turn to share with the GEICO Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
Napa know-how.
Get all the quality parts you need at your locally owned Napa. Because right now, when you order from Napa online, you can pick up curbside at your local store in just 30 minutes. Or get your order delivered direct to your door with free one-day shipping and over 160,000 quality parts when you spend $50 or more. Quality parts delivered quickly and safely. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating stores, standard ground shipping and exclusions apply.
Let's turn the clock back, shall we, to one of the most dramatic stories in Premier League history. Newcastle looked like they were cruising to the Premier League title back in January 1996. They were 9 points clear at the top of the table with a game in hand. However, they dropped points at Manchester United, went on this extraordinary run, and this is how the table looked 24 years ago. Manchester United 3 clear of Newcastle United. Now, Newcastle closed the gap to 3 after a 1-0 victory against Leeds. And during the last few weeks, there were a lot of mind games going on between Fergie and Keegan. Fergie talking about the fact that opposition were going to go soft on Newcastle because of Keegan's relationship. Keegan then snapped, saying, no, no, when you do that with footballers, like Ferguson said about Leeds, and when you do things like that about a man like Stuart Pearce, I've kept really quiet. But I'll tell you something, he went down in my estimations when he said that. We have not resorted to that, but I'll tell you, you can tell him if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title. He's got to go to Newcastle and get something, and I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it. Of course, it never transpired like that. United went and got that victory against the Middlesbrough on the final day of the season. Craig Burley with us and Shaka Hislop, of course, who was part of that squad. during that season. Let's just focus first, shall we, Shaka, on that rant. How aware, or when were you aware, of what Keegan said?
We heard about it in the dressing room after the game. It had been building to that, and not only what Fergie said immediately prior, but I just feel, as a team, we started to feel under pressure come the turn of the year. We've been flying up until January 1st, as you pointed out, and then to close out the season, I think we finished with three wins on the road out of 10, and that ultimately was our undoing. But then just before that Leeds game, Stuart Pearce announced, he was due a testimonial at Nottingham Forest, and he announced that Newcastle United were to be the opponents. This was a game that was going to be played a week after the season closed, and that prompted Alex Ferguson to say that Stuart Pearce and Nottingham Forest wanted Newcastle to win. We still had to play Forest in the league, and suggested that they would go easy on us because it would ensure that Stuart Pearce got a bigger gate for his testimonial, which Keegan was absolutely right. It was an unfair accusation on a player with a record like Stuart Pearce. But ultimately, it was Ferguson's mind games, and it got the better of Kevin Keegan, certainly publicly. But within the dressing room, we knew that had been coming. We'd been feeling the pressure within that dressing room building for quite some time.
Craig Fergie clearly got into his head.
Yeah, I think the way it was going anyway, that Newcastle United were imploding, as Shaka mentioned, and I think the title was heading to Old Trafford anyway. But I think, you know, the whole implosion from Kevin Keegan, and it's an iconic moment, whether you agree or not with the tactics behind it, I think really made it sweeter. And whilst Keegan was issuing his TV public rant, there was a man in Manchester sat in his armchair chuckling away like he'd never chuckled before, because he knew he'd won that particular battle, and he knew that was the sort of icing on the cake and the nail in the coffin, really, for Newcastle United. It is, after all, mind games. He had it with Arsene Wenger. He had it with Kevin Keegan. He had it with others. It was part of the Ferguson resume, really, was to make sure he, as well as putting good teams together, he got in managers' heads as well, and he certainly did that with Newcastle. It was a shame in a way, because Shaq knows better than me, it was a heck of a Newcastle side, but unfortunately they couldn't see it out, and United were ready to pounce. And I'm sure whether Ferguson went down in Keegan's estimation or not, I'm sure the United manager couldn't give a hoot.
Shaka, what was the talk amongst the players? Was there a kind of like a, wow, he's really lost it?
Yeah, there was, and without question, because you didn't expect that from Keegan. He tried to maintain an even keel, but you know, as I mentioned, from the players' perspective, we knew the pressure was getting to him, and as a result, it got to the players as well. That had been coming. And listen, Fergie ultimately was the main antagonist behind the rant and the main focus of that rant, but the pressure, and as I mentioned, the poor form away from home particularly, was telling. We changed how we trained and our weekly routines, and just because you lose a couple of games, you don't do that, and I think it sends the wrong message, and that certainly was the case. Again, as much as I understood and had the inside view of what happened and how it happened in Newcastle United, and I feel that Fergie was maybe a little bit unfair in some of his accusations, Craig's also right. If you're involved with Manchester United or you sat in that dressing room, you couldn't help but just chuckle away.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Just a reminder, ESPN FC back on your screens tomorrow. Be sure to join us. Well, that brings us to the end of today's edition of ESPN FC. A big thanks to Charlie Stilettano for joining us. Be sure to check out his podcast, The Hat Trick, available tomorrow with that exclusive interview with Gareth Bale. Also, a big thanks to Julianne Laurent for Shaka Hislop taking us through the Newcastle dressing room during that Kevin Keegan rant. Be sure to stay tuned, though. Extra Time is next with Gab Marcotti and Craig Burley. Welcome into Extra Time. Thank you very much for your tweets. Gab and Craig with me. Gab, there's a report that Juve will only give players for Pogba. Any idea of which players are possible? I would guess De Ligt and Dybala are out of the question.
Well, I mean, look, I think this report's based on the fact that cash is in short supply. And so I don't think it just concerns Juve. I think it concerns most clubs. So if they really are as obsessed with Pogba as people suggest, then you know there's only so many guys they can sell. I would assume, you know, you wouldn't want to sell De Ligt and or Dybala or Bentancur. Those guys are probably your most saleable assets because they're still young and they still have a market. So I guess it would have to be one of those guys. But bear in mind, too, United were linked to Dybala last summer. I don't know if they're still interested or where he would fit now that Bruno Fernandes is there, now that they're obviously going for Jadon Sancho as well. De Ligt is a Mino Raiola client. And so I'm skeptical when people draw up these massive player swap deals in football.
Meanwhile, Craig, who do you think out of Spurs, Manchester United, Arsenal or Chelsea will be the next contending for the Premier League? Whose trajectory is better?
Well, I know United finished before the shutdown relatively strongly, but I still think they've got a lot of work to do. I would probably say it's definitely between Chelsea and United for me, because I think United will spend, or at least some amount. I think Chelsea will as well, with the transfer ban being finished. I would probably say my old club, Chelsea.
Ask the hater, Burley, if a window of Sancho, Partey and Werner would have United as challengers to the top two.
Possibly. Yeah, possibly. Sancho, Timo Werner and Partey from Atletico Madrid. Yeah, that's three good signings. That might bridge. Yeah, that'll go some way to bridging the 37-point gap, I suppose.
37, ding. Which young player frustrated you the most by not becoming the world-class player they should have been, either by laziness, believing their own hype, or by partying too much? Gab, who springs to mind?
Well, I think there's an obvious answer if you're Italian, and that answer is Super Mario Balotelli. Now, there's been some revisionist history of people saying, well, I never saw it. I don't see what made him so good. And to those people, I'd invite them to go back and watch his goals against Germany in the Euro 2012 semifinal. But Balotelli is an obvious one that springs out there. One other guy I would mention, and it's not entirely his fault, and it's a totally different category because he achieved so much. But, you know, guys like Wayne Rooney and Michael Owen were never the same, you know, once they got past their mid-20s. And injuries certainly played a part of it. I do wonder, with hindsight, medical science maybe today being better than it was then, whether their careers could have taken a very different path, and maybe their longevity could have been maintained.
Craig, I read an article about Robbie Savage in a German football magazine. They mentioned a solid argument you had with him in a match. Can you tell me the whole story, or did they confound something in the story?
It wasn't so much an argument. It was an East Midlands derby at Pride Park, Derby County versus Leicester City in the Premier League. I think it was in the Premier League. It was in the Premier League. And the game wasn't going too well for us, and he was doing what he normally does with the chit-chat. And I think he dived for a penalty. And I did grab him around the throat. I was only helping him back up off the ground, but I did grab him. I grabbed him around the throat area. I wasn't sent off. But that argument, not between myself and Robbie Savage, that wasn't an argument. That was done and dusted. But the argument between the players continued into the tunnel after the game, which we lost 3-2, by the way. And I'll never forget, we were all revving up for a bit of a scrap until Eddie Akinbaye, the big striker for Leicester City, took his top off. And I've never seen a man so big and so muscle-bound. And I couldn't wait to get back in the dressing room and bolt the door. So that's how that one ended.
Okay, moving on. Can you rank the following footballers, Craig? Shearer, Ian Wright, Gary Lineker.
I rank them Shearer, Lineker, Wright. That's the way I would go.
Pierre Van Hooijdonk or Mark Viduka, Craig?
Wow. Well, both of them disappeared for a period because Van Hooijdonk went on strike. He left Celtic just before I got there, by the way, and Mark Viduka was a teammate of mine for a period. Van Hooijdonk went on strike at Nottingham Forest, and Big Viduks went on the missing list just after he signed for Celtic and went back to Croatia. However, he was found and dragged back to Celtic Park. So I would say, having not played with Van Hooijdonk, but know how talented he is, but having played with Viduka and know just how good a player he was, I would say Mark Viduka.
Meanwhile, Gab, where do you stand on pizza being in squares or triangular slices?
Well, okay, so they're not really triangles. Triangular is when you take a pizza and you cut it into eight slices. Obviously, it looks vaguely like a triangle, but the end is more sort of a half moon shape. Of course, it's eight slices. If you're very hungry, you might cut it into four slices. If you're less hungry, a square pizza. That's more of a thing that they do in Rome. Obviously, pizza didn't originate with Rome. But listen, I'm not a pizza snob. Pizza's not my culture. Pizza's from Naples. Other people have taken pizza. They've adapted it. Some people have made it better or acceptable. Some people have gone and screwed it all up by putting a lot of garbage on it. And those are the ones I resent.
Have you cut it into 16 pieces, Gab? Is that more pizza?
That's if you're really, really hungry, Craig. Or if you have, like, you know, then you might go for it. 16 pieces is too much for me. I normally, you know, go for eight or four if I'm not that hungry.
I have to say, it is one of my favourite dishes if it's cooked properly, but I can see that there's a man sat in the middle of us, Gab, who's a total Neanderthal when it comes to putting toppings on a pizza. I mean, good grief. It's up there with his dress sense.
Pineapple. Pineapple's a go-to, Craig. You've got to accept it.
No.
Embrace it.
No. If you went to Italy. Beautiful. And put pineapple on a pizza, I don't fancy your chances of getting out.
Final question for you, Craig. Do you have any superstitions or rituals before a match?
Yeah. What was it? I used to always try and go out last. It wasn't a ritual, but I used to try and make sure I had taken my teeth out and put them in my pocket, which I did forget sometimes. And then I was on the pitch a few times and the ref was not about to blow the whistle, but maybe a couple of minutes away, and I've had to bolt back down the tunnel and put them in. And the other time I've had to hand them to the kit man of the physio, which they weren't particularly pleased with because the game was about to kick off. But I used to touch the grass before it's horrible. And I used to touch the grass in the pit, just silly little things, and I'd put my shin pads on a certain way. The answer is yes. I used to try and do certain things in the dressing room, in the warm up, and before a game, just before a game. I just can't remember all the things that I used to do.
Gab, do you have a ritual, a superstition that you go through before a big article?
I don't. There's no such thing as superstition. It's all dark ages hearsay. And no, and in fact, sometimes I go out of my way to do things that people consider to be unlucky, just to go and prove a point.
Thank you very much. What a surprise, Gab. Just a reminder, ESPN FC back on your screens tomorrow. Be sure to join us.